and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the paradox that the people who support Donald Trump are the Americans who need government support the most, but want it the least, with many living amidst great industrial pollution who nevertheless dislike all environmental regulations. Arlie Russell Hochschild, one of the most influential sociologists of her generation, joins us to discuss her latest book, just out, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Over the past 5 years, she embedded herself in Lake Charles, Louisiana, among red state supporters of Trump and went to his rallies to find out why, as liberals often lament, working-class white Americans seem to vote against their own interests, which they are certainly doing, supporting such a manifestly false prophet as Donald Trump, who represents an oligarchical system that has left them at the back of the line. We will look into what the emotional or cultural self-interest is that sustains those that feel alienated and betrayed by their own government, and what can be done to bridge the gap between patronizing liberals and good-hearted folks who are falling victim to a political huckster. Then, on this anniversary of 9/11, we will speak with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA officer and author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Now the National Security Affairs Analyst at CNN, he joins us to discuss the continuing cover-up of Saudi Arabia's role in the 9/11 attacks and the alleged role of Russian intelligence in apparently interfering in our elections to help elect Donald Trump while undermining Hillary Clinton, who has already been a victim of damaging and well-timed data dumps that first revealed her private email server and exposed how much the DNC was covertly supporting her. We will examine whether the former KGB Colonel Vladimir Putin is using the SVR, FSB, and GRU to pay America back for what he sees as interference in his backyard in Georgia and Ukraine, and also look into possible ties between Russian intelligence and the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, as well as the former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, now marooned in Moscow, about whom Oliver Stone has made a movie that is coming out soon. All this from the perspective of a former spy familiar with the grey world of active measures and cyber espionage that has Putin's Russia, which has an economy comparable to Canada's, punching above its weight on the world stage. And joining us now is Arlie Russell Hochschild, who is one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. 3 of her books have been named as New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and her work appears in 16 languages. The winner of the Ulysses Medal and 5 honorary degrees, as well as Guggenheim and Mellon grants, her latest book just out is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arlie Russell Hochschild.
Thank you.
And your book deals with the great American paradox that the people who need government support the most want it the least. And indeed, you know, there have been books written about what's the matter with Kansas, et cetera. Liberals have wrung their hands for decades wondering why, in their eyes, so many working-class Americans vote against their own interests. But I take it that part of what you've done is sort of explode that kind of liberal bubble and bring texture and meaning to this paradox.
Right. What I've done is to get outside my own enclave here in Berkeley, California, in a Democratic state, and go to an equal and opposite enclave in the South, in Louisiana, which is kind of the super South, and try to take my own alarm system off and really get to know people and see if I could step in their shoes and cross what I call an empathy wall. And on the other side of the wall is a different definition of what an interest is.
Well, just to follow up, though, on the paradox itself, it is pretty clear, is it not, that most of the red states depend more on government spending and are less in the land of free enterprise than the blue states, who in effect, even though there's this sort of gulf in many ways, it seems like half the country is going back to the 14th century while half is moving into the 21st.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's true that the red states are poor. They have worse health, worse education, more dropouts. They don't live as long, and they depend more on the federal government and resist it more. And Louisiana is kind of a super example of the red state paradox, because it's now the poorest state in the union. It 44% of the state budget comes from the federal government, and they're going for Donald Trump.
And of course, the other paradox is that those who live amidst the great industrial pollution nevertheless dislike all environmental regulation.
That's right. That's right.
So that, again, it frustrates liberals, and I think it's reflected, is it not? I mean, I think a lot of liberals are absolutely having heartburn over the latest CNN poll that has Donald Trump ahead, 45% to 43% among likely voters. So is it possible that the constituency that you've observed is larger than we think?
Yes, it is possible, and more diverse than we think. I mean, you look at the crowds at some of the rallies, and there is this alt-right look. They're angry, mobilized. And you don't see the people who are scratching their heads and feeling ambivalent and voting for, or planning to vote for him anyway, because they don't feel spoken to by anyone else. So that really is a challenge to liberals, I think. Well, wait a minute. What are we missing here, and what are we not understanding? And that's really what drove me to spend this last 5 years interviewing and talking to. I began to think of it as interviewing, but I ended up thinking, they call it visiting. I would do an interview, and they'd say, oh, thanks for the visit. Come again. And so, I think we need to really understand the Trump supporter and see if there aren't crossover issues between left and right that we can focus on.
So when liberals believe that the political right, the working class right, the people that are flocking to Trump's banner have been duped into voting against their economic self-interests, you have discovered that there's something else going on here. That's a kind of patronizing notion, that really it's about what you describe as their emotional self-interest. So
cultural.
Elaborate. Yeah.
Yes. Well, a lot of them felt as if they were standing in line. Imagine kind of a pilgrimage up a hill, standing in line for the American dream, and you've really worked hard to get your ticket, and the line isn't moving, hasn't been, and then you see people cutting in front of you. Now, who would they be? In their perception, this would be affirmative action women interested in men's jobs, or blacks who were being given any help to get jobs formerly reserved for whites, immigrants, refugees, even public sector workers whose working conditions seem preferable to their own, although much of this is on assumptions, you know, that they make about reality. And then they see President Obama, head of the line, kind of motioning to these people who are cutting ahead, and as if he's their friend. He's trying to help them. And they, that is these right, older white Christian group generally, feel like they've been pushed back in line through no fault of their own, and have been marginalized. And then they elaborate on that, feel like the whole government is in a way a giant marginalization machine. And they distrust it. They feel it's not their government. And this is, in a way, in writing the book, I felt like I spent 5 years kind of studying the kindling. And then I went down in March to see Donald Trump the day before the Louisiana primary and the kind of electric response he got. I felt he was the match to that kindling, that they had come to feel strangers in their own land, and he was promising them to become, to reclaim that land. And, yeah.
Well, he may well do that, well, at least get elected. Whether that fulfills the promise is a huge question, but there's no question that if you ask the, you know, you do understand what Donald Trump stands for in the simplistic sense that he's going to make America great again and build a wall. If you ask that same question of a Hillary Clinton supporter, you get a deafening silence because it's not clear what she stands for, even though she's got 1,000 policy positions, all of which are highly expanded upon. And you can, if you can go to the website and spend a few days, you'd learn about just about everything that is important to governance. But that's not counting in a curious way. And how do you think that bubble could be burst in the simple sense that it is a tragedy? On the one hand, these people should not be taken advantage of. They should be listened to and understood.
Right.
But they are being taken advantage of by Donald Trump.
Yes,
there's no question.
I think so.
And
yes,
they're going to be left high and dry. So
How
do you somehow make it? Doesn't seem like Hillary Clinton's the right person to make that case.
But if she's who we've got.
Exactly.
And,
so what?
Yeah.
How do you proceed?
Okay. I think that you say that, you know, Hillary is offering something, I think, which is unity rather than divisiveness. But what she needs to say is unity includes white, blue-collar men. And, you know, we've thought of, oh, if you're a white man, you're very privileged. But there is a large group in the United States of white men for whom the privilege of manhood and the privilege of whiteness really haven't trickled down. And they're the ones to be that have been forgotten. So I think Hillary needs to reach out to them and also acknowledge some of the pain that has been experienced. I think that's, you know, it's not all sugar and light, and that would help too. But I think the whole glass ceiling, you know, the first woman, that's one thing, but you have to talk about what the ceiling meant and whom it's for. I think I have to speak to the exclusion of whites, actually, without falling into some racist thing.
But privilege itself.
I think that, in other words, I think there's something magical. Just go back to Trump. Magical in his promise. And as you're saying, look, that a lot of people are being set up for a huge fall. I think he's offering, my own interpretation, is a secular version of the rapture, in a sense, that he's, you know, promising that the good will rise up and you know, there will come a judgment day and that they will be found good. And the people I talked to and really came to know, really pretty extraordinary people, really, felt like their goodness was not seen or acknowledged. They felt very put down by liberals. You know, oh, so-and-so is a redneck and no education and flip-flop shoes. There are a lot of insults that float around rather than a genuine, respectful effort to kind of reach across and see what our common ground really could be. There was quite a lot of common ground, I actually found. A lot of people, and these were super right-wing, you know, really diminished the government, who had a kind of friendly feeling about Bernie Sanders. "Oh, Uncle Bernie," they would say. I thought, well, this is interesting. And one guy, Tea Party, said, you know, we really ought to get money out of politics. I told him, well, you have a crossover issue there. But why aren't there conversations going on that make that visible? And, you know, they were agreed on a crossover issue of reducing prison populations for nonviolent crimes. They were all on board that. And I think we could make a very powerful crossover issue with the environment. At the moment, it's seen as a liberal cause and saving the toad. And many in the South see this as, you know, moral carpetbaggers come in to tell them what to do, and they're very leery of that. But at the same time, environmentally, they are living with a very difficult high pollution situation in Louisiana and would welcome this as a crossover issue.
But when you say, Ali Russell Hochschild, that there's a sense of the end of white privilege in itself has an ugly history with slavery in the South and then Jim Crow. And in many ways, you could make the case that the poor white farmers and blacksmiths that fought for the Confederacy were actually fighting for the plantation owners' right to replace them with slaves. There's always been this lack of sort of understanding or accepting the idea that we have a class system in this country, and in many ways our democracy is being replaced by a plutocracy.
Yes, completely right. And I go into that in Strangers. I looked at the book by the historian Cash, Mind of the South, and he traces the experience of the ancestors of a lot of the people I talked to. We're poor whites. And when the plantation system came, they were pushed to the marginal lands. And even when the plantation system, you know, moved to other states, they took up the good land, and the plantation owners didn't need white labor because they had slave labor. So these people were kind of in marginal lands and living off the grid with what they could grow. But even the good forests were cut down. So, you know, they've got a history. And the paradox and the sad part is that given that history of rich landowners really abusing poor farmers and tenant farmers, independent farmers, even given that, the tenant farmers identified up with the white plantation people and not with the you know, demoralized, traumatized slave. But so I think that characteristic goes back. But I tried to point out, wait a minute, your interests have not always, you know, have not coincided with the big plantation owners. And now in Louisiana, the plantations system is, in a sense, continued by oil.
And in oil, of course, is also the source of so much pollution as well, is it not?
Louisiana. It is. And not that many jobs. In my calculation, some 15% of all the jobs, at most, were associated directly or indirectly with oil. Many of those companies are based abroad, you know, British Petroleum in London, Royal Dutch Shells in The Hague, Sasol's in South Africa, and so on. And they are highly automated, and they sometimes import cheap Philippine pipe fitters. So it's not a lot in it, actually, for poor whites. And this has to be brought out and could be in civil conversations across differences.
And I always find it so extraordinary that you have these two worlds of people worshiping Jesus Christ in such different ways, the black churches and the white churches, many of whom belong to the same denomination. And you often sort of wonder, you know, it might be a good idea for the preachers to swap churches every other Sunday. How do you deal with this notion, again, of the idea of Jesus not as the prophet of love, but as somebody that hates homosexuals, loves guns, you know, shakes down poor people for money on television, all of that stuff that we associate with the white evangelical movement that in many ways seems, first of all, it has become a front for right-wing politics in this country, not to mention a means that have enriched a bunch of hucksters.
Right. You know, on this environmental issue, I found that the evangelical churches generally were silent, but on the at the national level, and I write about this in the book, there is a movement of creation care that's beginning within the evangelical church of environmentalists who are picking it up. They do it differently. They say, well, this is for, you know, the unborn child. We're wanting to get rid of pollution. But, okay, you know, one could form an alliance. This is among younger evangelicals.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, then, Arlie Russell Hochschild, your book is extremely valuable in this election season. There's no question about it. It's must reading for anybody that's trying to understand this phenomenon. And we don't know the depth of it because it's not out of the question that Donald Trump could be elected. What, in the end of the day, do you think could break the spell? I know I've asked you that before, but in terms of healing on both sides, the illusions that liberals have has to be broken, and the false prophecy on the right has to be broken.
That's right. And I think on the liberal side, I mean, my book is a wake-up call. I think we've been asleep. The things are going on, quote, the other side that we know not of, and they feel hurt by liberals in ways liberals don't intend and don't feel spoken to at all. It's something cultural beyond policies. It's policies, of course, but even the policies that you would think would help them are not couched in a way that they can culturally hear. So my book is really a call for reaching across empathically and having living room conversations and looking for, common crossover issues. And that, I think, can help break the spell. But it's a wake-up call that we really need to talk to the people who are under the spell.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Arlie Russell Hochschild.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Arlie Russell Hochschild, as one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. 3 of her books have been named as New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and her work appears in 16 languages. She's the winner of the Ulysses Medal and 5 honorary degrees, as well as the Guggenheim and Mellon Grants. And her latest book just out is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning, on the American Right. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back on this anniversary of 9/11 speaking with a former CIA officer about the continuing cover-up of Saudi Arabia's role in 9/11.
You've been born with white skin, they explain, and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain. As he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game.
But they beg you, wave my name. I got one hell of a job, we're born for the U.S. of A.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished officers in CIA history. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And Oliver Stone has a new movie coming out about Edward Snowden. I've seen some trailers now on television. And as you know, the New York Times did a big front page, extremely extensive article about 2 weeks ago on Julian Assange and to a lesser extent Edward Snowden and their connections to Russian intelligence. And there is a fear amongst a number of Democrats that Julian Assange is going to be good to his word, that he's going to dump a bunch of dirt on Hillary Clinton prior to this election. And there's some possibility, I guess, that some of this dirt was gathered by Russian intelligence, who have considerable resources. So what do you think Putin is up to in his apparent interference in the U.S. elections?
Well, Ian, I think he's running a masterful, masterful covert action campaign. I just look at the evidence that's been released so far from Assange and Snowden. And when you're an intelligence officer, you look where the damage has been done. Damage has been done against the United States government. Whether it's right or wrong, it really doesn't matter at this point. And it's been done against Hillary Clinton, which for me as a former intelligence officer is to conclude with a fair amount of certainty that Assange is manipulated, at the very least, by the Russians. Putin does not want Clinton as president. He's concerned that she'll pursue, sending NATO arms, more arms to Eastern Europe, a missile shield, which will directly affect Russian security, will continue sanctions, and her advisors are what I'd call, they're just neocons. So he has motivation, and he has the ability through WikiLeaks, through Assange, and even Snowden, Snowden is basically a prisoner in Moscow, of continuing to do damage. Now, if Snowden have gone to Ecuador, someplace like that, and dumped on both the Russians and the United States, I'd take that all back. So I think the Russians, for the first time in my lifetime, are coming after the Americans in a big way, and we are so lazy on security. Most of the Russian technology is bought in Israel. It's like we develop it, like getting into the iPhone, sell it to the Israeli government or give it to them, and then they turn around and sell it to private vendors, and which ends up in Russia. Also, the Russians are very good at doing their own hacking. And Putin is looking at this and say, I have a hostile United States, I have a hostile Hillary Clinton, and I'm going to do my best to take her down. And that's my best estimate of the situation.
Well, interesting enough, the Russians are using Israeli drones in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. Again, the U.S. developed drone technology, and the Israelis are selling it to the Russians. So I guess that supports...
Wait, do you know where all the Chinese technology comes from? But like Polytechnology is the big arms dealer from Israel. Right. We watched over and over again. The Israelis sell it to the Chinese. They develop the weapons. But originally the technology is coming from California and other American defense companies. It's just we watched it over and over and over again. You couldn't do anything about it. And the same way with hacking and technology and, getting into iPhones and the rest of it. It's very brilliant technology. But it goes to Israel, then to Russia.
So what is this Israel-Russia connection? Because, we know from the emigration that took place that the total electoral map in Israel has been changed forever and has moved to the right. You've got a former bouncer from a nightclub in Moldova from the Soviet Union as a major political player and now the foreign minister of Israel. And you've got all these Russian gangsters operating in Israel. My understanding is that a lot of the intelligence people in Israel are less concerned about the Palestinians and more concerned about Russian gangsters.
Ian, I'm glad you said that. I've spent a lot of time with Israeli police and Israeli intelligence, you know, over the last 15 years. And I remember sitting down once with the chief of police of Haifa on the record in front of a camera, British camera. And we were sitting in a restaurant and had been blown up by a Palestinian, not too many years before, by a Palestinian woman, had killed 21 people, children, adults, the whole family. It was an atrocious act, also killed Arabs. And he looked at me and said, you know what, I'm not worried about Hezbollah and I'm not worried about Palestinian terrorism. I'm worried about the Russian mob in my country taking it over. And then this guy was in uniform and as serious and as honest as they come. I mean, it just completely floored me. And then the hotel we were staying in Haifa, there were Russian gas companies, front companies running it. And the Israelis, I think their biggest problem now is not Hezbollah, which is, by the way, withdrawn from Lebanon to fight in Syria. It's all their missiles. Yeah, fine, they're there, and it's a threat. But I think the biggest threat is organized crime, Russian organized crime. And these people do not play around. And the Israelis are scared of them.
So you've got the Russians having extraordinary influence. I believe Israel's new defense minister is also from...
he's Moldovan. He was. If you're a bouncer in a Russian or Moldovan nightclub, you are mob. There's no ifs and, you know, it's like going to work for the Gambino family. You're not doing humanitarian work there.
Right. So far I've been talking about Russia's influence in terms of Julian Assange and, to a lesser extent, Edward Snowden, about whom Oliver Stone has a new movie coming out. Let's walk through some of that influence that you've mentioned. Julian Assange, I take it, might well be more of a useful idiot than an active employee of the FSB. But the real question is, we don't quite know where the funding for WikiLeaks comes from, do we? I mean...
Somebody like Julian Assange, I don't think he sat down at a table across from a KGB agent and said, all right, I'm going to sell my soul to you. You simply do this with false flag. That's the way intelligence runs. And that is somebody with, you know, sort of a reputation that would fit the framework. Oh, by the way, I also have access to expose, you know, Bush administration lawbreaking. And State Department stupidity, you know, and you know, you look at all the WikiLeaks stuff, and they are exposing stupidity and incompetence, but you never let on to either Snowden or Assange. I mean, they're basically loose cannons. That this is an organized KGB operation. That's just very unprofessional. But on the other hand, they don't really think much through it. That's the problem. I mean, the Russian spies have, even after the Cold War, are very, very good. I mean, we've seen incompetence on their part, but at the end of the day, Putin, a former KGB officer, knows his intelligence operations. And look, you have to put yourself in his place. If I could throw the American elections the way I wanted, what would you say? Putin says, yeah, if we can do that, let's do it. I mean, he's pursuing Russian national interest. Say anything you want about him, but that's what he's doing.
And that is, Russian national interest is that we've been meddling not in his near abroad, but in his backyard.
Exactly, we have. I mean, the Russians truly believed there was a promise in 1991 that we would not push NATO onto their borders. Now, I don't know what was actually said to them or put on paper or at the meetings with the ambassador, but that's what the Russians believe, and that's what Putin believes. He believes that we humiliated them at the end of the Cold War and continue to. I've dealt with the Russian government in Central Asia. They just didn't. I mean, they knew where I worked and, you know, for the CIA, and they just did not trust me with a dog bone. And it doesn't matter whether they're right or wrong. They just didn't. They said, why do you guys have embassies in Central Asia? Why do you have them in the Caucasus? And what are you doing in Georgia? Why are you pushing the Abkhazia issue? There's Russian nationals there. And when I was in Central Asia, the Russians soldiers, border guards, were getting their heads cut off by an Afghan group which we had funded. And they were using the heads to kick them around, the Russian soldiers. And it doesn't mean we're supporting Putin here or the Russian style of government, which is an autocracy. I'm just telling you where they're coming from and why they'd have the motivation to involve themselves in our election.
And when you mentioned earlier, Robert Baer, that Edward Snowden is effectively a prisoner in Russia, the New York Times' recent investigation indicated that he was basically guided and moved to Russia from Hong Kong by Julian Assange and his assistant, Sarah Harrison. What went on there in that decision? I mean, Assange apparently said that you'd be safer in Russia. And I spoke, that makes sense in as much as had he gone to Ecuador, do you think that the U.S. could have snatched him?
Ecuador would have. We could have forced them to give him up. But Russia, no. And if you're in Hong Kong and you want to go to Russia and claim asylum, you have to do this through Russian intelligence. It's not like you go to the Russian, consulate in Hong Kong and say, oh, I would like to apply for asylum. And they go, oh, you're an American? Sure. No, this is all orchestrated. And Russian intelligence had to be involved in the question. The foreign ministry there, national security, they defer to the KGB, which are, in case Hong Kong was the SVR, but that's neither here nor there. And then that goes right to the top. When you have an NSA contractor with gigabytes of information that's classified, and whether it deserves to be classified or not is just completely irrelevant, that goes right to the Kremlin. And you say, what do we do? And Putin signs off it. Take him. Now, I just don't know whether that Snowden was originally met in Geneva or Hawaii. It really doesn't matter. But once Assange sits down and works with the Russian government to get exile in Russia, he's become party to an intelligence operation.
Well, we know that Snowden, I think it was 2008, 2009, he worked for the CIA in Geneva in IT and was caught trying to break into the Director of Operations files. Is that any kind of a flag?
That's a huge flag. And they should have flagged it to the, they probably did flag it to the FBI. And the FBI said, well, did he make it in across those, those walls, those Chinese walls? And digital says, there's a big, huge one between a guy working in IT and Director of Operations file. So he had to really be doing some hacking. That's a fireable offense for sure, and he did get fired. Now, the question is, why didn't the CIA put out a burn notice on him, telling all the other, like the National Security Agency? I don't know the answer to that. They probably regret that they didn't, of course. But there's just no reason for somebody like that to try to get into operations files. Not that there's any great secret there, but it's a red flag, huge, fat red flag.
So how did he then get another job, but with a contractor, by the way, not with an NSA? And, of course, one of the extraordinary things was that he was able to take so much information out over such a long period. And apparently he was aware that the National Security Agency was starting to install a program in their vast databases in their various stations around the world. And, of course, ironically, the last station to get that, in effect, warning that there was anybody extracting large amounts of information was the station in Hawaii, and he managed to leave just before they started to install that algorithm that would have detected extractions of information.
Well, Ian, there are algorithms detect people siphoning off information, but they're overbilled and sold to the National Security Agency as being foolproof. And, well, clearly they're not, obviously. And as far as the CIA not telling the contractor, there's still stovepiping. There's no unified database. I mean, that should have gone to the FBI computers, which apparently it didn't, and it should have gone to NSA, and it should have gone to contractors. This guy is a problem. It's just like the FBI doesn't, you know, the local police, if you buy an automatic weapon, the local police or the merchant won't tell the FBI. And you may be on, like a guy in Orlando. That didn't red flag the FBI to go see the guy again. Those, the whole database thing about, you know, they're all that, you know, 9/11, pre-9/11 stuff is over, is obviously not true.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, and we are going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished officers in CIA history. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. So I'm still trying to get a handle on the idea that Assange and Edward Snowden, what their relationship is. The long investigation piece in New York Times a couple of weeks ago didn't really have any conclusions. They sort of made lots of insinuations. But I'm trying to figure out the idea that these, you know, maybe we're in a world where individuals can basically rattle the cages of vast and powerful countries. At times, I find it extraordinary to think that the power that one person has to, you know, as a journalist, you're always in favor of information, no matter where it comes from. So I'm loath to criticize the messenger if the message is important. But on the other hand, I don't think you can discount the role of the personal biases of the messenger that cloud the message. And even Snowden himself has criticized Assange for his reckless curation, as he calls it, of some of these purloined files.
Well, I mean, Ian, I agree with you, but all we have to go on is neither you nor I have access to the FBI's file on Assange. There may be some really smart guy that's gone through all of his telephones, the metadata, which he got from the British police and the rest of it, and says, look, this guy is a Russian asset. We don't know that. But the only thing we have to go on is, where is the damage done? And it's been done to the United States. It's been done to Hillary Clinton, who happened to be both Russia's enemy, you know, in this post-Cold War world. So, you know, if we have to sit down and we have to make a bet, I would bet that Assange is in some way Russian-controlled, whether it's through a proxy or directly. But that's just the evidence we have. That's the forensic, no-nonsense evidence we have, and that's what we've got to go with.
So do you expect then that he's going to have an influence over this election? Again, I get back to the idea that we now live in a world where a couple of individuals, Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, can really rattle the cages of, you know, not just...
I think, you know, short of a depression happening before the elections, that Russia will have the greatest influence on these elections than anything. Because among the people that really don't follow the news, it's let's put Hillary in jail. And they're basing that on the leaks and the server. The only way you're going to know that Hillary was using a private server is if somebody had gotten into it and watched this. What's the point in, you know, surfacing this about her cell phones, her commercial cell phones, if at the end game is not to take her down?
Well, that's,
if she was on those cell phones, you know, talking about family investments or even the Clinton Foundation, nobody would care. Somebody knew that was getting into that, that in her staff, I believe, were putting classified, arguably classified stuff on those. And so when you do a covert action operation, you got to know where you're going. You just don't throw the Clinton stuff out there and find out where she was a great mom and had forgiven Bill and all this stuff and a great family member. What's the point? You have to know it's going to harm her. And if Trump is elected based on this stuff, we can thank the Russians.
Well, but specifically, we would never have known about the service but for the fact that the story was broken on RT, which is Putin's English language propaganda outfit, Russia Today. And that was broken, released by them as a, quote, public service in March of 2013.
No, exactly. I mean, that's not conclusive. It's, you know, it's RT picked it up and maybe no one else wanted to in the U.S. media. But, yeah, I mean, absolutely. You add up the evidence, and to me, if I had to bet, you know, I'm living way up in the mountains, that Assange and Snowden are somehow manipulated or controlled directly by the Russians. I truly, truly believe that. And by the way, I think all those leaks that Snowden put out about this crazy, you know, giving AT&T bills without warrants, warrantless wiretaps, is a good thing for Americans to know that the government after 9/11 ripped up the Constitution. So, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just, I'm just pointing where the evidence is going.
Well, let's turn then to your expertise in the Middle East. And we've had lots of conversations about the pernicious role of Saudi Wahhabism. And interestingly enough, one of the more hopeful strains of Islam was and is the Gulen movement in Turkey, where, for example, Gulen urges his followers, particularly the wealthy ones, not to spend money on building mosques for self-aggrandizement, but to put your money into education, which is entirely the opposite of what the Al Saud family is all about. They want to keep their people under the yoke of medieval Islamic education. And all they do is throw money at the Wahhabis while they live behind walls in extreme luxury and come over, and the princes come over here to Hollywood and Bel Air to rent big mansions where hookers arrive in limousines around the clock. So,
you know, Ian, I've got to say something. Now we're talking about Saudi Arabia. This is my hobby horse. But if, you know, they built this mosque in Culver City, which ultimately served supporting the 9/11 hijackers. This is, everybody should acknowledge this. If we sat down with the Saudis and say, oh, by the way, we would like to build a synagogue in Riyadh, they just laugh. They would think we were nuts. I mean, how is the Saudi government, Ministry of Religious Affairs, gets to build mosques around this country and preach violence, and we say nothing? I just find that extraordinary. Or that we stopped the Saudi role in 9/11. We still don't know if they had a role or we didn't have a role because the FBI and the 9/11 Commission were prohibited from investigating it. We are in crazy territory.
Well, it's not that they just build mosques here; they build them around the world, and more than that, they've helped create the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram.
I watched the mosque, the Saudi mosque, go up in Casablanca, which became, the Moroccans were a fairly moderate form of Islam, and so was the king. And they got in there and threw their billions around, and now we have Moroccans in Paris and Brussels blowing themselves up. This is completely alien to their religion. It has to be, the rudiments of violence has to come from somewhere, and it's coming from Saudi Arabia. You know, you get to Turkey, and that was the great hope, too. But now, with the Islamic State, which even the New York Times has admitted, which is huge, is both the arsonist and the fireman. So, if they're supporting the Islamic State, and that's the conclusion of the New York Times, and that's the Journal of Record, and they are pushing this chaos up into Turkey, and you look at Erdogan, for one, number one, he didn't agree with the invasion of Iraq. It wasn't his fault. And number two, now that's arrived at his doorstep, and if I were Erdogan, I would panic too. And I would call out the moderate Islamic elements in his country and build a wall to this. But he probably looks at us, as Putin does, and says, you guys are out of your minds letting the Saudis get away with this and saying nothing. I mean, we in effect support Saudi Arabia spending $1 trillion for defense in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. We are the Air Force for Saudi Arabia and the Navy. So not only are we subsidizing them, we're subsidizing their energy exports. And if you're a fossil fuel person, they're undermining our markets in this country. Like, you know, who cares if you're against fracking or not? That's what the Saudis are doing.
Right. Well, they're also the second biggest investors in Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. And Murdoch's News Corporation, and particularly Fox News, promulgates global warming. So you can see a connection there between...
Oh, they are totally behind this anti-scientific theory that this is just natural causes global warming. I mean, you've got Miami is going underwater, and that, you know why Miami is? Because of cheap oil from Saudi Arabia, which we've subsidized since the end of the Second World War by providing defense for them. They pump in the cheap oil. They control, you know, they get the media saying, oh, no, don't pay any attention to, you know, people like you and me. They're in the fringe, you know, everything's fine. Never mind that the 15 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, the muscle, that they were from a particular tribe. And never mind the Saudis never bothered to tell us how they got recruited and how they ended up on those airplanes. That's okay. You can murder 3,000 Americans, but keep sending us the cheap oil.
And keep buying our weapons, right? Isn't that a...
Oh, yeah, weapons. Yeah, but I mean, you know, you can blame this on the arms merchants, but at the end of the day, we have to export something for the cheap oil.
No.
I mean, you know...
But it must be more than...
Hollywood can only export so much.
Right, but there must be a deeper connection here, because I can't for the life of me to understand why we keep turning the other cheek as the Saudis stab us in the back, because it must be to do with recycling all their money on Wall Street.
We recycle it on Wall Street, but you have to look at them as the pusher, and you and I are meth addicts. We are not going to sit around and complain about the way the guy's dressed or what he's driving. Just keep sending the meth. And you know, anybody that complains about it doesn't understand. I mean, Ian, we're not talking about conspiracies here. And there's nobody in a cigar-filled room plotting this out. You have the son of the king says, look, American solar power, fracking, and the rest of it, they're taking market share. So he turns to his oil advisors and say, run those guys into the ground. You know, wind farms and the rest of it. Make it so uncompetitive that they go down. And that it's a very simple decision, and it's not something they call up the State Department and say, this is what we're going to do. You just do it.
Well, but do you think that this young king, who apparently is a real hardcore Wahhabi, his father's the current king, apparently has some form of dementia or Alzheimer's. He's taken over a bunch of portfolios, defense as well as oil. Got himself in a war in Yemen that's hideously destructive, that the UN is screaming about the humanitarian catastrophe that the Saudis are creating, but yet everybody in the region sees it as the American-Saudi war. And
it is the American-Saudi war. I was talking to Doctors Without Borders, and they gave the coordinates of their hospitals in Yemen to the Saudis and the Americans, and what they truly believe is that those coordinates were used to guide in missiles.
And why would the U.S. and the Saudis want to blow up MedSans Sans Frontières hospitals?
We don't want to blow it up, but they think that Yemen's an existential threat to them. So they've come to us and said, look, well, you know, we're going to ignore the Iran agreement right now, but we want you to go in full blast in genocide in Yemen. And the State Department and the White House, and it's a president I support, felt they had no choice but to turn a blind eye. There's nobody in the United States that wants to kill Yemenis or even know what a Houthi is. You call the State Department up and ask them what a Houthi is, and I bet you don't find one person that understands their form of Islam. They don't care. We're not doing this to kill people. We're doing it to curry favor with the pusher, and that's Saudi Arabia.
So do you, in spite of much, you know, you mentioned the New York Times expose recently. I believe 60 Minutes is working on another story. You and I have spent time with Senator Bob Graham, who's been quite heroic in forcing the declassification of those 28 pages. There are efforts underway to not just question this relationship. I believe a couple of senators have also made rumblings about legislation, etc. How do you see, given that the pusher, that we've been addicts and the pusher has had this influence over us for decades?
Well, where do you think Bush made his money? Harkin Energy. You know, all of this came from Bahrain, but Bahrain, the economy is controlled by Saudi Arabia. He bought the Rangers thanks to selling Harkin stocks a week before it collapsed on a fake field in Bahrain. I think this is a matter of record. Mm-hmm. So you have a president of the United States who is not only friends with Bondar, which I don't have any problem with, but he was also made all of his money that he used to buy the Rangers. He's on the tit too, you know. Come on, you know. Once you accept foreign influence, whether it's Russian or Saudi in this country, you're going to go down like Rome. The barbarians didn't invade Rome; they just walked in and one day said, "It's ours."
The gates were open.
The gates were open, yeah, and we've opened the gates.
Well, Robert Baer,
And don't forget, one last thing, is the Saudis' royal family sitting on a volcano there, so their motivations are mixed, too.
You mean their own people living in one of the...
Yeah, if they don't continue the crusade, the Islamic crusade abroad, then they go down.
Right. Well, their own people live in the most repressive country on the world.
And the impoverished.
Yeah, an intolerable situation. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished officers in CIA history and the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.